This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking again today with Marianne Garneau, an organizer and educator with the Industrial Workers of the World. She's also a publisher of Organizing Work at organizing.work. That's an online publication written by and for workers who are trying to organize their workplaces and want to learn both from what does and doesn't work. For the last few weeks, we've been talking about big strikes and the sabotage of labor, the name and theme of a piece that she wrote late last year about the labor movement and how it used to be grounded in direct shop floor action for controlling the workplace and asserting workers' fundamental power in it, and its transformation into a beast of bureaucracy and legislation, and ultimately is about tying the hands of workers and making it so that they cannot use the power that everyone knows they have. Last week, we were talking about public sector workers, and we had gotten on to talking about just the nature of so-called whistle bargaining on the shop floor, and whether something like that would fly in workplaces today.
So that kind of immediate stop and go, screw it, we're downing tools until this particular grievance is fixed, and a lot of those grievances had to do with the pace of work. That's what the labor movement used to look like, which is absolutely unheard of today. So I take you to be asking, if people acted that way in the case of a lot of public sector work, wouldn't that look like screwing over students and screwing over patients and whatnot? And the answer is, like, not necessarily, right? Because I am in regular contact now with teachers, workers in healthcare, and a lot of time what their issue is, what their grievance is being told to do ridiculously unsafe things at work. And unfortunately, the union system we have nowadays generally says, work now, grieve later. You know, people think, oh, well, health and safety complaints are an exception to this. There's a carve out for that. Yeah, kind of technically, legally, there sort of is. But on a day-to-day level, for the most part, you cannot simply stop work. And the union is not even structured to defend you if you stop work. And by that, I'm referring to, for example, refusing to do something unsafe, refusing to do something ridiculous that the employer is asking you to do, and doing the right thing instead. For the most part, unions are no longer the kind of institutions that have the capacity to back you up in doing that. They still try to, right? But my point is that for the most part, that's not what worker activity looks like, and that's not the kind of worker activity that is sanctioned by the legal system and by the government, and therefore it's not, for the most part, the way that unions are able to behave. They have to behave in such a way that they use these formal processes instead. So public sector workers can and should be able to control their work on a day-to-day level, and in fact, a lot of times they do kind of manage to get away with controlling their work on a day-to-day level in a way that does serve the public better than if they were simply following the rules. One of the ways that ends up unfortunately happening is like teachers bringing their own supplies into school. That's not an exertion of power in relation to the employer, but that's skirting the way things officially work in order to actually deliver a better product to the public or a better service to the public.
Just in the last few years, there were lots of collective refusals by teachers to administer standardized tests, which is refusing to, you know, do the work that is expected of them by their bosses. And yet it's not working. They're choosing to do something else, something more educational. I mean, just the other week on KBOO Labor Radio, two Portland public school teachers were hosting and talking to two other Portland public school teachers about why they, as workers, as teachers, and as members of their union, why they oppose MAP testing and how they're working with parents and students to put control over classroom time back in the teacher's hand. And I'm wondering whether this is a missing piece of the puzzle around when people say direct action gets the goods. Direct action isn't just this negative thing where we're stopping another agency from acting through us, but rather reclaiming our agency.
Yeah, the reality is that workers are the best judges and adjudicators of their own work, including best serving the public and so on. I have a kind of frustration with the bargaining for the common good language, which is what gets used to describe when you reach out to the public and build those supports with them in advance of bargaining, like teachers have done in Chicago and elsewhere. That kind of implicitly frames the public interest as being different from the union's interest. We've had an anti-union narrative for decades that says that they chauvinistically and selfishly want to bargain up their own wages. They want to bargain up their own benefits. They don't care how much it costs the employer, how much it costs the public. They don't care if this negatively affects workers elsewhere, which it actually doesn't. But they selfishly care about their own interests. And that's what unions do, is they just narrowly fight for a better deal for their own members. And the insight of bargaining for the common good is supposed to be like, okay, let's go to the public and ask about what they want and then try to bring that up to the bargaining table and create an alloy of worker interests and public interests. And I call BS on that. I think that worker interests are public interests.
That reminds me of how a month ago on Democracy Now! They quoted AOC supporting the Hunts Point produce market strike, and she was saying, when you're standing on this line, you're not just asking for a dollar, you're asking for transformational change for your lives and for the lives of every food worker across the country, for kids of food workers across the country, because there's lots of things upside down right now in our economy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care whether it's public sector or private sector. Anytime workers bargain their wages up, that's a good thing. That's good for the working class. First of all, it's good for those workers, and they're part of the working class. And second, that does empower and encourage workers to strike elsewhere, and it also encourages employers to increase how much they pay, because now they're in competition with that other employer to attract workers. So it's just a good thing.
I want to return to a little bit of the history here of the transformation of labor struggle from shop floor to contracts and collective bargaining. That was a phrase invoked by one of the historians you quote as a failure for the labor movement, when I think the normal narrative is that earning collective bargaining rights through the NLRA was one of the grandest achievements of 20th century labor. In what sense was it a failure?
Well, one of the things that struck me that I put in the article is Martin Glaverman talks about the Flint sit-down strike. And he points out, he has a very short book or pamphlet called Punching Out. He points out that the contract that was won by the Flint sit-down strike was one page. And quoting Glaverman, he says, the old-timers look on that as the contract under which the greatest gains were made, because the bargaining and the decisions were made by the workers on the job. There wasn't enough in it to prevent the workers from doing pretty much as they pleased. Four men, for the first time, asked the steward how much production the department would get so he could plan accordingly. The steward consulted with the men and then gave his answer to the foreman. So workers collectively making decisions at work about what the pace of work is going to be and then delivering those instructions to the boss. That's incredible. And over time, contracts have evolved in two ways. For the first couple of years, they were giving workers more. We heard about that with the Treaty of Detroit thing that I mentioned. So they're giving workers more job security. They're giving the union more security in the form of shoring up its position as the recognized bargaining agent, ensuring that all members of the workplace would be members. And they were giving workers more for a while in terms of wages and benefits. But what workers were losing was the ability to democratically decide issues of production and to push back on things like that and to take action in the workplace. And so you eventually had things like management rights clauses, which said, like, everything outside of this contract is just entirely management's prerogative. The business belongs to them. They get to make all decisions with respect to running it. It really eliminated that day-to-day struggle between workers and bosses over the pace of work and the nature of work. Contracts, as we know them today, outline things like wages and benefits and, to some extent, working conditions, but all control is given to management with respect to the flow of work, the type of work, the nature of work, when it stops, when it starts, when it gets shut down completely. And that was a huge loss.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marianne Garneau, with the Industrial Workers of the World and publisher of Organizing.Work, talking about big strikes and the sabotage of labor and revising some historical notions we have about workers' power. So what does it mean for workers today who have a union or most of them don't, as far as engaging in collective action to change their workplaces, that there is so little intuition around it? There's so little in the culture that supports workers having a say. We don't have that same intuition, it seems, that workers had 100 years ago around controlling their work, because it's them, it's their life. How do we make labor struggle about having agency as a worker again?
Well, there are places where that is still happening. One of the places they're still happening is in a lot of IWW organizing, which is what continues to make it interesting, where instead of simply signing cards and petitioning for a certification election and getting formal recognition and then sitting at the bargaining table, workers just take direct action in the workplace in order to get their demands met. And I collect those stories on Organizing Work. It's one of the reasons I started the website, because I do think it would be nice for workers to just see what that could possibly look like and possibly follow that example. One of the other ways that you can disseminate that kind of practice is through education programs, which is why I think that labor education, popular worker labor education, is very important. It's why I'm a trainer of workers for the IWW's organizer training program, which just basically entirely empowers them. How do you do this yourself? How do you talk to your coworkers? How do you start making decisions collectively with your coworkers? How do you take action in the workplace? How do you protect yourself from retaliation? And most people in the labor movement, when you try to describe that to them, honestly just can't grok what you're talking about. It runs so counter to the way that unions normally look and labor is normally organized. It's not even that people are necessarily hostile to it, but it's just something that's been entirely written out of account by the labor relations model. In the U.S. context, you fortunately still have what are called Section 7 protections, where you are allowed to take concerted activity at work to try to improve things on the job. In Canada, which is often looked to as a kind of bastion of social democracy compared to the U.S., including with respect to labor relations, you don't have those protections. You absolutely are expected to follow the formal processes of getting formal union recognition and then bargaining at a table. And if you don't do that, the labor relations board and most unions look at you like you've got two heads. They think you're trying to cheat and skirt labor processes. Again, this is a tradition that's largely been written out of account. There's also one more thing I want to say about sabotage. I think the important thing about sabotage for anybody who's listening to this and thinking about their own workplace is that it's not something you want to undertake individually. It doesn't work because you just happen to have thrown a shoe into the machine. The only reason it works is because workers collectively have an intention to slow down work or to refuse certain kinds of work or what have you, right? If you're in an assembly line and you just hit the emergency button and stop that assembly line, you're just going to get yourself disciplined, if not fired, and in trouble. If all of the workers on that assembly line collectively made a decision to shut down that assembly line until some grievance was resolved, they have more protection in that because they can't all be dismissed or fired or production doesn't continue for that day. So sabotage, especially among young people and leftists and in our very, very individualist society, is often thought of as like, haha, all I have to do is throw the switch and then I'm a hero and I've got one over on the boss. The reality is nothing could be riskier than acting as an individual. The important and significant sense of sabotage is for people to be doing something collectively.
And that makes me want to ask a bit more about what I think we can put a finer point on about the relationship between building worker power and then having the big movement. I see you as sketching out a theory of power where we get to the capacity to pull off big, powerful action by developing a ground level understanding of our own capacity to then coordinate and our own capacity to, I don't want to say do what we want, but do what we need to do. And could you speak more to that relationship between the two levels? Because I know in the IWW, there has been controversy around, you know, how do we organize? Do we organize shop by shop? Or we're an industrial union. Don't we, you know, need to organize whole industries? And I see you as intervening in that by saying, how do you think we get to industrial scale organizing without having a workers' culture of this shop floor struggle?
Yeah, I ran a piece recently, not by me, about the Alphabet Workers Union at Google and how it's the latest example of top-first organizing, not top-down, but top-first, which sort of describes how you can build all kinds of beautiful structures from above that say, like, this is going to be a union for, like, all, I don't know, Whole Foods workers or Instacart workers or every rideshare driver or everybody working in tech. But if you never really fill that in with worker action at the ground level, then it kind of doesn't really tend to go anywhere except in media spaces, let's say. To the broader point about building worker power, talk to any union organizer and they will tell you how difficult it is to build towards a strike, how much work is required to build towards a strike, especially in a large bargaining unit with a couple thousand or tens of thousands of members. I mean, it's just hours and hours and hours of building members up and agitating them about the issues, encouraging them to go on strike and building towards that strike vote. And it's very difficult to organize. And the reason it's difficult to organize is because the rest of the time, the worker's job is to basically keep your head down and report to work. And if you have an issue on the job, you're supposed to hand it off to the grievance process and to the labor relations staff, basically, to address in that boardroom that is off the worksite. It's very hard to swing from that kind of passivity in that service model to suddenly you're out risking your ass on a picket line and out on strike with your coworkers. And so one of the jabs I make in my article is about how people love to look back at these huge strikes that happened, like the Flint sit-down strike or other ones in the 1930s and say, like, man, look at how militant these workers were. Just like hundreds of or thousands of workers sat down at once and went on strike. And my point is that the reason why they had that ability and what was sort of like fertilizing that was the fact that they exercised control on the job on a day-to-day basis. They did engage in things like sabotage and intermittent strikes and group refusals and pickets and whatever. It didn't look like balloting for a strike every 3 years. It looked like a constant day-to-day fight with the foreman in the shop. You know, like the metaphor that you read at the end of my introduction, it's like demanding a wheel without an axle. The people who really want to reinvigorate the big strike, my question is, how do you really do that in a powerful way while completely giving up and writing out of account the whole issue of the day-to-day struggle over the shop floor? And people recognize that we can only get the kind of big strikes that matter if we are willing to defy the law, if we are willing to sort of be more militant than the law allows us to be. How are you going to get workers to that level? I think you have to build on a sort of shop floor level and engage the immediate practice of collective action at work on a day-to-day level if you're going to get there.
There is this counterintuitive route to the big strike that we don't organize for the big strike per se. We build up worker power and a sense of agency over the work that we do and our dignity when we're doing it. And that is really the goal, to have agency in our work lives and maybe even someday like call it democracy or something. But it's more transactional to just look at like the big strike as kind of like what organizing is, what the prize is that we're supposed to keep our eyes on. And it's really helpful the way that you're trying to bring these back together, because it's a missing link and it's hard to see, because it's not like the end all be all of like the labor movement is to just go on strike. Big Bill Haywood, you know, famously said all the workers have to do is get organized and put their hands in their pockets and they'd have the employing class whipped. But it's not like that's the point. The point is that is a tool in this larger project of reclaiming our lives at work.
And it's about day-to-day dignity on the job, and it is about that democratic worker control. I want to read one more quote from the article, which is an IWW spokesman who said in 1913, so decades before the Labor Relations Act, the employer can better afford to fight one strike that lasts 6 months than he can fight six strikes that take place in the same period. I think that's absolutely true. I previously, about a year or two ago, wrote an article called Why Don't Strikes Achieve More? And it was right after the settlement of the Stop and Shop strike, as well as, you know, I think that one of the symphony orchestras and big strike in Canada at a grocery. I think every single one of them settled with a two-tier contract. Those were all-out strikes, actual withdrawals of labor power. They were majoritarian strikes. They lasted for a long time. The workers fought incredibly courageously, and they probably got a better deal than they would have had they not struck. But there's a bit of a mythologizing of the strike, like, well, if only we would strike, then we would get what we wanted. And reality is that's not the case. And it's not the case because, again, the labor relations framework overall has so tamed unions. If you go on strike, your employer, they know from the minute they sign the contract when that strike is going to be. It's going to be after the expiration of the contract. They also know that first the union has to do things like ballot for it and prepare for it and whatever. They also know exactly what it's going to look like. It's going to look like an orderly picket line, you know, for the most part, right? And they get to replace those workers with scabs and so on and so forth. It's extraordinarily constrained. It still does matter, absolutely, and it still does affect the employer. But the all-out strike every couple of years is a tactic that employers are very much aware of and prepared for, and they've had basically like 90 years to figure out workarounds. Whereas ongoing disruption on the job, I think, is something that they have less of a response to. And it's worth us as the labor movement investing in that kind of thing, so that we can engage in that and we can develop power from the bottom up again, and it'll make us all the better prepared to carry out big strikes.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That's all the time we have today for my conversation with Marianne Garneau, but we're not going to make you wait another week to hear the rest. When you go and find today's show posted in the next couple days at kboo.fm/oldmole, we will have an additional 15, 20 minutes of conversation that completes our long series of talks about big strikes and the sabotage of labor, published at organizing.org. Thanks for coming back on the Old Mole, Marianne Garneau.
Thanks for having me back.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement. I want to double back and switch gears and talk about labor legislation. now that Democrats have gotten control of Congress and the presidency, there's a lot of hope about passing the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act. And while fundamentally it reasserts the industrial peace prerogatives laid out explicitly in the National Labor Relations Act, there are a lot of labor folks who are hopeful that it's going to repeal many restrictions on strike actions that were put in place by Taft-Hartley, including secondary strikes and so-called intermittent strikes. In what ways do you think this could create opportunities for a rekindling shop floor struggle, but also how do you think the labor relations system is still going to limit the power of workers to effectively strike?
I'm not a close follower of big P politics, but I do remember the fact that the Employee Free Choice Act, which was supposed to be passed under the Obama administration when Democrats had control of both houses and they had the capacity to do that, wasn't passed. I think that's an obvious thing to point to not necessarily get your hopes up about the PRO Act. But just speaking more broadly, in general, within capitalism, it doesn't work that you elect the right people into power and those people pass the right kind of policy from above, and that gives labor breathing room, and now we can build back our power. That's also not what happened in 1935 with the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, and I do think that's something that people get wrong, where they act as though out of government largesse, almost, the government suddenly just handed workers a bunch of rights and said, God bless ye, go organize, and then all of a sudden we got unions. The reality is, for years prior, there was organizing going on. It was very thorough, it was very militant, it was very widespread, and it was in many ways successful, but it was very volatile, where you had strikes and lockouts constantly, sometimes spilling out into bloody street battles. And what the government was trying to do with the Labor Relations Act was to get rid of that kind of volatility and violence and unpredictability. And the full title of the act is something like an act to diminish the causes of labor disputes that interrupt interstate commerce. So that was the government interest, is getting workers back to work, getting production flowing again. So here, the employer has to recognize the union, has to sit down at the table and bargain with them, but by God, get production flowing again. Fast forward to today, there's no reason to expect that you're suddenly going to get some kind of, you know, favor from a government simply for ideological reasons. The labor movement has to incentivize the government to create more breathing room for it. And what really actually it is, and what really happens, is there's a new compromise that gets struck. So you can have, let's say, more recognition of the union, more formal or protected bargaining processes, or higher wages, but then something gets taken in return. Like, again, comparing the US to Canada, it's easier to get union certification in Canada. It's also easier to get a first contract in Canada. But by God, in exchange, you have to color within the lines. So in the US, if you want labor to be in a better position, a better bargaining position, if you want it to grow again and be strong again, that's not going to come in the form of a sudden shift at the legislative level to make labor more powerful again. There's better and worse policy. There are better and worse rules that get handed down by the Labor Relations Board. And they're, you know, worse under Republican administrations, and they're better under Democratic administrations. But you're not going to build back the labor movement and redevelop the power of the labor movement by having the right bit of legislation passed. That's something that has to be incentivized from the ground up by actually fighting.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marianne Garneau, organizer and educator for the Industrial Workers of the World, talking about strikes, worker power, and what it's going to take to revive the labor movement to actually be the transformative agent that we once and still believe it could be. It's not just about strike and worker power as this negative enactment of our agency to stop something, to stop the employer or to interrupt production, but to recognize that only on the basis of, like, we really have this power, and it's power in the sense of the power to do, you know, whatever we want to create the world that the whole working class has created for hundreds of years. It's becoming unalienated from our power in that sense, because that's what becomes the real reason why we continue to invest in organizing to fight the industrial system, capitalism, whatever you want to call it, is not because us and them and fuck them. It's a matter of we are fighting for something. And that for something is also found in what we're fighting with, which is our power.
I agree. How workers feel when they walk into work is a huge function of what kind of empowerment they have in that context. Now, you're never going to be totally empowered within capitalism, right? Alienation is not a psychological interior phenomenon. It's a structural function of capitalism where you don't own the product of your work. And that's true even if you're a teacher and if you work in a factory making widgets and if you're a waiter and what have you. There's a certain amount of alienation within capitalism that's like, that's how the system works. However, how you feel walking into work on a day-to-day basis as a worker has everything to do with how much control you feel like you can exert on the job. And that's a function of how much, you know, solidarity and ability to act in lockstep that you have with your coworkers. And a long time ago, we kind of wrote off the notion of having control over work on the job, whether it's the pace of work or what kind of work we're doing, what it looks like in the details, when it happens, and so on. And there are things around the edges that make it into contracts, but for the most part, that's not considered something that we fight over anymore. And that's, I think, too bad, because I think that has a lot to do with just what it feels like to be alive. We spend most of our waking lives at work for the most part still, and it matters what it feels like to walk into work and how much control you feel you have.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that came up for you that you think would be good to cover?
The only other point I would bring up is about leadership.
Like union leadership?
Like the people who take themselves to be the progressive wing of the labor movement these days tend to be of like the Trotskyist flavor, and they tend to think that the strategy needs to be replacing the formal union leadership with people who are more radical and more, you know, socialist and more militant and radically inspired. And what I think is significant about these earlier forms of worker power is that they engaged a different kind of leadership, a shop floor leadership on the job that was not a matter of a more enlightened steward or union representative or whatever, giving more militant or radical direction. It was a matter of the workers themselves leading efforts of refusal. It was democratic in that way. It was horizontal, if you want to call it that. But nowadays, the most that we will allow ourselves to imagine is undoing the purges of the Red Scare and bringing back committed socialists to the union chain of command or something, including all the way down to the bottom, or having maybe more socialist rank and file workers in the workplace. But to me, what matters more is what the collective decision making and what the collective action looks like. And I think it should be something that is deliberated upon on the floor or by the workers themselves. It's a completely different notion of leadership, but I think it's far more important.
You even hear a lot of, as you refer to, labor luminaries like Jane McAlevey pointing to the efficacy of organic leadership on the shop floor, but then kind of repurpose that within the idea of a union drive within the labor relations framework. And I even kind of put this question to one of my union officials in Oregon, AFSCME Council 75, when she came on to talk about strategic vision, and I noticed references to being member-led. And I asked her, could you say a bit more like how we're member-led and how that's different? And her example was like, oh, well, we had members at a bargaining table and they were able to more effectively bargain with their bosses because I wasn't the one at the table and they couldn't say that it was a third party, and yet kind of leave out the fact that there's a different level of member engagement and being driven as a union that doesn't get at. And I'm wondering, you know, how do we continue to head that off and inoculate workers against the idea that our unions will be more democratic if we just plug more members in at the top rather than change it from the bottom up?
I think that's a great question. I do think that things matter, like member involvement in bargaining, obviously, or having open bargaining. I think that, you know, member mobilization and engagement, as they're often referred to, are important things. There's still a slight difference between that and what I'm describing, where I'm interested in the workers who are immediately in the workplace affected by a decision, making immediate decisions in relation to that and reacting to that. That is a different kind of approach, I think. I also want to separate this slightly from the Jane McAlevey bit about leadership. I think she's actually very good on leadership and about the difference between worker or union activists versus organic social leaders and the importance of getting the actual organic social leaders on board. I think all that stuff I basically co-sign happily. I wrote an article once called Leadership is Not Governance. So if you leave the whole union effort in the hands of the organic social leaders, that's not exactly the same thing as having it like broadly democratic and inclusive and having decision-making be genuinely sort of inclusive and representative of the entire workplace. These are kind of like maybe slightly downstream technical points about labor organizing, but I think they're important. You're right that a lot of unions refer to themselves as member-led, and that can cover over a whole lot of different types of things, right? It can mean a lot of different things.
And in my own union, AFSCME, the fact that we vote on our contract is held up as, look, we're democratic, and yet the actual kind of proposals are crafted with this very close hand from a staff and elected leadership, making sure that we draw within the lines, even though there are members also involved in the bargaining team.
So a couple things. First of all, the bar has been set very, very low in a lot of ways over the last few decades by the labor movement, where some corners of the labor movement started to behave so conservatively, let's say, and in such a sort of close partnership with management that anything that really pushes against that starts to look radical. The other thing I will concede is that people who are staff or even elected officers within a union today have significant constraints on the way they are able to operate. Now, you can be more inclusive of the membership than not when it comes to something like the bargaining process. You can be more transparent. You can have open bargaining or not. You can put things to a vote or not. But at the end of the day, they don't have the liberty of, say, completely encouraging worker disruption on the shop floor level. They simply don't have that capacity. That is a ULP. That is something in most, you know, circumstances, that's something the union can be fined for. That's something that, again, we have legal constraints on the way that that can operate. The grievance process is such as it is and not otherwise. It's not something that says, oh, and if you don't like it, you can settle this on the floor. It
says can you talk more about the limits that you just referenced? Because there's also cases of unions deciding to take the risk of flouting the limits that all of the rules put on unions and their leaders. And sometimes they break the bank and get sued or whatever, but other times they're able to push an issue further and then back away before experiencing those consequences. It seems like can't is kind of a moving target to say they can't do certain things. They can do things and then they can negotiate the consequences, it seems sometimes.
They can, depending on the kind of show of force you bring, you may be able to negotiate down fines. You may be able to do a trade-off where the fines are forgiven in exchange for making some concession. You may be able to get something out of a wildcat, even if the union does end up getting significantly financially punished for it. I mean, there are constraints. There are unions who are willing to toe the line more than others with respect to those constraints. But my point is that bargaining and the grievance process don't just look however you want them to look. Like, those are particular kinds of processes. There is room within that to have, like I've been saying, you know, open bargaining or not. There's room within that to have a more sort of membership inclusive orientation. But at the end of the day, the grievance process is still meant to take place away from the shop floor. The contract is still meant to foreclose economic activity or disruptive activity during the life of the contract. Like, I think the union should push for the more radical side of that spectrum. But again, I don't think that the solution is to have leadership that is enlightened or daring enough. I mean, I published a story recently about union leadership calling basically an illegal work stoppage and no worker following suit because it hadn't actually been organized. The real kind of militant radical change that we want to see has to come from the ground up. It's not just going to come from having a different appetite for risk taking at the top. You really have to build the capacity for power at the level of the rank and file, so-called, in order to have the leverage that you need to push those boundaries.
Yeah, it reminds me of how grating it is sometimes for me to hear the blanket promotion of, like, you know, have these workplace issues, join a union, want better pay or benefits, join a union. And the emphasis being on, like, join the union, and there's just this structure that comes in and changes things, when the reality is you don't change anything unless you organize, and that organizing a union is different than, though they can be cooperative, it's different than joining a union.
Yeah, just like the employer for formal legal reasons, being required to sit down at the bargaining table is different from them actually giving you anything at that bargaining table. The former is a legal technicality. The latter is a matter of how much power you can mobilize to wrest those concessions.
In my own union, we kind of had a staffer, you know, remind us that, like, well, the employer doesn't have to bargain over these issues, but we can raise them. And it gladdened my heart to hear a different worker pipe up and say, okay, if they don't have to, how can we make them? How can we make a problem for them that the solution has to do with them, you know, figuring something out with us?
Absolutely.